Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with My Opel, rewarding loyalty and taking care of members.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
It's time now for the gathering, and it's been a week where the government expected to dominate the news agenda with its reopening roadmap and the Housing for All plan. That was until we heard about those now infamous texts from the Piglet.
The time is now right to begin the move from regulation and widespread restrictions on people's personal freedom to an approach primarily defined by public health advice, personal behaviour, judgment and responsibility.
That's the way we roll. We show respect to other people on the bus and on the train, but it's also the law.
I am positive, but I think that the government is not being cautious enough around the reopening of schools.
I'm no Michael Gove, but I do look forward to the dance floor once again.
Like a lot of people, I suspect, I don't hold on to text messages for long periods of time in terms of data on my phone and so on.
Then it was because of a fear of being hacked. How do you explain all of this? What is going on?
Taoiseach and leader of Fine Gael, Leo Varadkar, has released the actual text messages between himself and Catherine Zappone. Hi, Leo from the Piglet. I was expecting to hear from Simon C about my appointment as Special Envoy for Human Rights and LGBTQ plus issues. Have you heard anything?
Do you delete text messages?
A number of my text messages relating to government business have appeared on the front pages of newspapers through FOI, so I don't routinely.
Do you, for example, delete text messages that you get from ministerial colleagues?
Sometimes I do delete texts if they come through and I've dealt with them quickly.
All I'd say is during the course of the issues concerning the matter and the incident for which I was held responsible, I was told this issue was dominating the public domain and was getting in the way of government business. Some would argue that this is getting in the way of very difficult government business too.
We are talking about a part-time position of an envoy. I don't think it's at the scale that you think it's at.
A desperate effort to cover their tracks. So the whole thing stinks to the high heavens.
It is exceptionally important that Cabinet's confidentiality is protected.
That is absolutely unacceptable that leaks would happen like that. But, you know, that's for that individual, you know, to...
It's a really serious matter for government.
I don't accept at all that the housing launch today was overshadowed. Those who want a home are interested in real policy and real issues.
I don't think it's being overshadowed. It's certainly a shadow.
All right, certainly a shadow. That gives you a good overview of the week. And I'm joined in studio to discuss all of that by Dr. Jennifer Kavanagh, Law Lecturer at Waterford Institute of Technology, Kevin Doyle, News Editor with the Irish Independent, Jennifer Carol McNeil, Fine Gael TD for Dunleary, and Matt Carthy, Sinn Féin TD for Cavan Monaghan. You're all very welcome to the programme. Thank you for being here. Kevin, I just want to come to you first because there's a number of different elements to that story, the Merriongate melodrama, some are referring to it. Can you run us through those elements and recap the further intrigue in relation to the whole controversy?
Yeah, well, I think we've kind of reached a point, Claire, where, and to use the cliche in politics, if you're explaining, you're losing. And senior ministers in government have now spent the entire summer explaining or trying to explain exactly what was behind this appointment of Catherine Zappone and how it was handled. And they're only, I think, now reaching the conclusion that maybe it was handled really, really badly. And I think that's a big part of the problem here is that when this first came out, it was kind of dismissed as a nothing story. You're all getting a bit hyped up. Sure, Catherine Zappone is well qualified for it. And they missed the point that this was a €15,000 job and that there was no advertisement. Nobody knew nothing about it. And that basically it was being discussed about between text messages between former ministers and current ministers. And so there are layers upon layers upon layers. But I think if we come to where we are today, because your montage there kind of gave a good timeline of it all, we're now in a position where Simon Coveney, despite several attempts to clarify things, every time he clarifies a point here, another question comes up. As recently as this morning, last night, the Department of Public Expenditure said that there was no communication between themselves and the Department of Foreign Affairs about the money to pay for this role. And then at 11:30 last night, they actually sent my colleague Philip Ryan an email saying actually there was a query from the Department of Foreign Affairs asking if a former minister, unnamed, were to get a UN envoy role, would it affect their pension? And this is where it happens. So they're fighting with Fianna Fáil on one level, albeit the Taoiseach seems to be standing by his constituency colleagues for the moment. They're absolutely fighting with the opposition in the form of Sinn Féin and Labour, and I think Sinn Féin are kicking sand to see how much of it will stick. And then even within Fine Gael, there are rows over how this is all handled, because it is their top two men implicated, Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney, the people, I suppose, who are supposed to lead from the front, are the ones at the centre of this. And then within Cabinet, there is that separate row about an unnamed minister who allegedly leaked the appointment in the first place and was getting blamed by Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney for causing all of this furore in the first place.
Okay, there are a lot of things to address there, Jennifer. Carol McNeil, I don't know which part of it you want to talk about first. Maybe we'll come to the last part that Kevin mentioned there, because we were talking to the Finance Minister about the leak from Cabinet. He did acknowledge that it's extremely serious that that happened. Is there disquiet in the party about that, about the fact that it was leaked from a Cabinet meeting, which we know is against the law, first and foremost?
I think any Cabinet leak is just unacceptable. The basic principles of Cabinet are collectivity and confidentiality. Cabinet can't function properly without that. You have to have the trust of your government partners, you have to have the trust of your Cabinet partners, and it's just simply utterly unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And that's my strong view and the strong view of the party.
There doesn't seem to be any appetite to find out where that leak came from.
I don't know the answer to that, Claire. I really don't know the answer to that, because I don't have any more information about it than anybody else. I'm not in Cabinet. But I heard the Minister for Finance, who has been in Cabinet for many years, give his very strong view, and I'm saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. It is utterly unacceptable.
It was interesting yesterday that Catherine Martin, the Green Party Minister, said this is an issue for Fine Gael.
I think it is a matter for the government, and I think it is a matter for any party in government.
But she narrowed it down, didn't she? She said it's a matter for Fine Gael, the leak.
Well, what do you want me to say to that? I don't have any more information about...
Her point was that it is not a government problem, it's a Fine Gael problem.
I think in the sense of anybody in government, it is a government problem. Government is governed by the Cabinet Handbook, it's governed by the rules there, it's governed by the constitutional principles, as I've already outlined. So I absolutely think it's a matter for any person, whether they're an independent, whether they're a member of party, and it's a matter for the collective government and how government functions.
Okay, Matt Carthy, we have a housing crisis and there's an attempt to solve that with the publication of the Housing for All plan. We have a society that needs to reopen, and we're hopefully getting there as well. Issues in health with waiting lists. This is a distraction, isn't it? I mean, what more do we want from this?
See, the difficulty, Claire, is that this issue and this debacle highlights one of the reasons why we have crises in our housing system, in our health system, in so many other areas of public services. And it goes down to the level and comes down to the level of trust. Whether or not the government can be trusted to make decisions, make appointments, take out other actions on the basis of what's in the best interest of the Irish people, or whether they're doing it at the behest of friends or insider or cronyism. And this goes to the heart of all of that, because this shows that a key decision was made by the Minister for Foreign Affairs, not on the basis of anything other than who happened to have access. So we know, and what we found out this week is that Catherine Sapone texted Leo Varadkar. On the basis of that text message, three things happened. Leo Varadkar contacted Simon Coveney. Simon Coveney then made contact, despite what he had said earlier at the Oireachtas Committee, with Catherine Sapone directly to discuss and finalise and lock down, essentially, this appointment to a made-up job. And then Simon Coveney contacted the Secretary General and told him basically to get this moving. And that's the type of insider crony politics that we've seen all too often that affects all those other issues that you're talking about.
Nobody has said, though, have they, that Catherine Sapone wasn't qualified to do this job?
I'm not necessarily sure she was eminently qualified, considering the fact that she has refused to actually enter into this discussion that centres around her over the past number of weeks. I think that casts judgment on her position. But the difficulty was that this position was a made-up job, and nobody can convince me otherwise. It wasn't an urgent position, and it was created at the behest of Catherine Sapone.
We don't know that, do
well,
we?
Well,
we don't know
and
that.
And that's part of the difficulty, because we also don't have full information. In fact, we've contradictory information. I think what needs to happen this weekend is that the Taoiseach take leadership on this. I was very disappointed to see yesterday. He was basically going back to the initial speaking points, as Kevin has described, that this isn't a big issue at all. It's been overblown. But what happens now, and what needs to happen now, is that the Taoiseach needs to sit Simon Coveney down and tell him he needs to come before the committee next Tuesday. In that, before that, all the documentation needs to be produced in relation to this appointment.
That's not what he's doing.
No,
exactly. Well, Jennifer McNeill, you want to come in there? Go ahead.
That's exactly what he's doing. He's already directed his department to make sure he is invited. The Taoiseach doesn't need to sit him down and do anything. He has made himself available to the committee, not for the second time on Tuesday, and directed his department to make sure that all of the information is published prior to that. This is having been in the committee this week. There's no intention to try to hide anything here. Minister Coveney has made himself available, will make himself available again. The Taoiseach did a full interview on 6-1. I think it's very clear this was handled exceptionally badly, can I say, and that it should have been dealt with appropriately. But I think that was acknowledged and apologised for some weeks ago, and apologised for again. And I think that's really important.
One point,
but may I just say two things. The question of, you know, Matt's favourite phrase is sort of cronyism. Catherine Zappone is one of the longest standing LGBTQ campaigners in this state. There's no doubt about that. And as for being a Fine Gael crony, she was appointed by Fine Gael as an independent senator. She voted against a Fine Gael Labour government several times. She ran against Fine Gael candidates in a general election in 2016 and again in 2020, having been cabinet colleagues. So, like, could we call off the cronyism bit? This is about Catherine's ability. Now, look, it was handled exceptionally badly. As I've said, there's no doubt about that.
I want to bring in Jennifer Cavanagh, then I'll come back to you then. What do you see as the most serious issue in relation to all of this, Jennifer?
Well, it comes back to failings with the FOI system. And year in, year out, there's always something about things being redacted, too heavily redacted, information that doesn't seem to be available, but is available. It's something that's constantly been going on, and it's something that needs to be addressed, that if we want to have open government and transparency, we need to ensure that records are kept properly, that they can be accessed, that it's not down to whether someone's on annual leave or not, whether you get it. Yes, the cabinet does have cabinet confidentiality. It's needed. They need to have that space to make those decisions. Like, there's the famous Yes Prime Minister clip about, you know, not making decisions because of what's written on the front page of a newspaper. But if you look, say, at Scandinavia, stuff can come out within 4 days. You don't have to wait 30 years under the National Archives Act or try and request under FOI. And it's something that we really seriously need to get a handle on in this country, because at the end of the day, we're the ones who are electing in the politicians that become the cabinet ministers, meant to be working on our behalf, you know, because we all can't go into the cabinet. And that until there is a proper workable system that allows for that space and allows for that transparency, with that bit of reflection time where everything isn't coming out within 5 seconds, that's only when you will actually address the core of these issues, and will always keep coming up until that is actually addressed.
Okay, Matt, you wanted to come in there earlier.
See, Jennifer says mistakes were made and, you know, we need to learn from them essentially and move on. The difficulty is the mistakes are being repeated. I have in front of me the letter that Simon Coveney sent yesterday to the Oireachtas Committee on Foreign Affairs. It is the absolute definition of arrogance. He has refused and is refusing to acknowledge his role in creating this, what was, in my view, a scandal, and it was a scandalous act of cronyism.
I will repeat that.
He's refusing to accept that there was anything misleading in what he told the Oireachtas committee last week, when clearly there were a number of issues in his testimony that have since been proven to be different to as he outlined them. There is no acknowledgement of that. There is no acknowledgement of the fact that this goes to the heart of how decisions are made, and that there is zero level of humility or any recognition that this has caused.
But he has agreed to go to the committee again in short.
And I think it will be important that when he comes to the committee, and this is the point I was making, that when he comes, he is up front, and that the documentation that relates to this appointment is produced, not just the number of hours.
To be fair to him, he said he didn't have the text messages at the first appearance, and he said he was recalling what was included in those text messages from memory.
And if you look at the testimony extrapolate what he had said previously, he had indicated that he had read those text messages after the appointment was made, when the initial debacle took place. Now, at some point after that, he decided to delete those text messages. So there's huge questions that need
Jennifer,
to be answered in that
huge,
respect.
That's a huge allegation. I wouldn't ever say something about that, like by the timeline, because the implications of what you should be really careful with that, Matt. You said there, you're quoting the committee, you're quoting the minister. Did you also notice, because you're saying that this was essentially a readied up job because Catherine Zappone asked for it by text message in July. The Secretary General of the Department of that committee said that he had been working on this since March, that he'd been working on the development of this position since March.
Nobody is
saying
that this goes back to 2020.
So it's also in no sense a readied up job. This is by no means the first. Tom Arnold is envoy for food. Is somebody suggesting that he isn't qualified?
No,
for
I'm
that
suggesting
possession?
That this job was made up for Catherine Zappone.
Ireland is going in to take over the presidency of the Security Council in the coming weeks. And part of that is to represent how strong Ireland is and is genuine leader, having brought in marriage equality as early as it has.
So will this envoy be filled during that 1 month period?
I certainly hope that it will
be
filled.
It won't be.
Whether or not it can be filled with a process, I don't know the answer to that. But I think Ireland's position on LGBTQ rights is internationally recognised. It's a perfectly reasonable thing to try to progress as a member of the Security Council. And it's a perfectly reasonable thing.
Said yourself,
it
was the process
was
that was badly handled.
Kevin
Doyle, can I bring you in here? I don't know if you heard Brendan Howland, the Labour Party TD, on the show earlier, but he said that this speaks to the balance of power within government, that in his experience, nothing goes to cabinet without the Taoiseach knowing about it beforehand.
It absolutely does, Claire, and I think it goes back to all those relationships that are happening within government buildings between the three parties. And it's always harder to manage three parties than two, to be fair. But the problem here is that when Micheál Martin came in, as the school principal, there was already the guys who were running the school there when he arrived. And they did things their way, and they had their people in position, and he had to come in. And he can only shake it up for a little while, because he's actually going to give them back the keys in a while. So it really is testing the relationships. And it's for Micheál Martin, it's a difficult one, because I think Dara Cleary and Barry Cowan were somewhat seen as disposable. And I don't mean that disrespectfully to them, but they were only in office a short period of time. And it was seen as you can put them out. They haven't set in a massive body of work yet, and we can replace them, and we'll move away from those controversies very quickly. Simon Coveney and Leo Varadkar are in government buildings for 10 or more years. They are the top of the food chain. And it does appear that Micheál Martin isn't ready or prepared to pick a row with them on this issue, and it seems on perhaps other issues, or at least that's the way people in Fianna Fáil perceive it. So there is definitely the pendulum swings one direction, and I think it was Mark McSharry who was trying to make out the point, and I know Mark sometimes now can be a bit OTT on some of these things, but he was saying it's one rule for Fianna Fáil and no rules for Fine Gael, and it does kind of appear that way, and perception has a lot in politics, holds a lot of weight.
Jennifer?
Well, I think one of the important points of difference with Barry Cowan, for example, is I understand that Taoiseach gave him an opportunity to come in and answer questions in the Dáil, as plenty of other ministers have done, as Simon Coveney did this week in the Oireachtas Committee, as Helen MacIntyre did at a different stage. I understand he declined that opportunity. If you're a minister, you do have to be held to account, as is happening last week and this, and that's an important point of difference.
So the situation isn't comparable as far as you're concerned.
I think if he had come in, and then there was some possibility then, but he didn't come into the Dáil, is my recollection of that.
I think they are very different, Claire, but yeah. It's not even the situation in terms of, I don't think anybody really, and I'd say Matt would never expect that Micheál Martin's going to call in Simon Coveney this afternoon and tell him, you're gone, good luck. And then call in Leo Varadkar and say, find yourself a new foreign affairs minister because I've just sacked Simon Coveney. That's not how it works in a three-party coalition. But I think where it is comparable is you saw the Taoiseach yesterday talking about a melodrama and suggesting that we've all lost our minds over a silly season story, while not talking more about the upset that there was a €15,000 job handled this way and that there's been a drip, drip, drip of information. So I think that's the difference. It's not necessarily the sacking as such, but it's just the public commentary on it.
Okay, I'm going to move on to the Housing for All plan, which was announced just yesterday. And Jennifer Cavan, I'll come to you first. From what you've read, from what you've seen about this housing plan, do you think we finally have something that will transform housing in this country?
Well, the hope would be that we do, because things have to change. Like, most of my friends are all renting. We are the ones who are stuck with, say, the 10% deposit that you need to get. The house prices keep moving up and up and up. So something needs to be done. And I think whatever the government now at this stage can reasonably throw at the situation to get things moving has to be done now at this stage.
Yeah, one of the big challenges, and we had the CEO of the Land Development Agency in earlier on this morning, and he was talking about the challenge around finding the labour and then the cost of materials. He's under pressure to get things moving as quickly as possible. And yet he's talking about not operating in a cycle where prices are really high. That's a challenge in itself, isn't it?
That's actually the reason the Land Development Agency was established, was to try to provide that counter-cyclical balance over 5, 10, 15, 20 years when all of us are gone. That's the value of the Land Development Agency, to be able to assemble land banks strategically and in advance of need, to be able to do like what John was talking about with strategic partnerships, to activate land and turn in Dublin and Cork in particular, where it has gotten permission and where it hasn't been used, where it hasn't been built to everybody's detriment. And then that comes under the aegis of the Land Development Agency into affordable housing. That's something that they can get going straight away. Mm-hmm. There's 5,000 properties there available, as he said, for that. So that is one of the that is the key challenge that we've had. Constant boom bust because of land price speculation. And the Land Development Agency, which I was involved in establishing in the Department of Housing, that's the whole point of it, as recommended by several reports and the NESC reports over the years, is to try to provide that counter-cyclical influence so that it can release land when things are low, and that it can operate literally counter-cyclically. That's why it's been capitalised mm-hmm. in the way that it is from ISIF funding and given the power to invest in other ways.
And Matt, if they get this right, they'll take the legs out from under you.
Genuinely, Claire, I want housing policy to be got right, because I deal with people. I have family members who are paying extortionate rents, who are find themselves on housing lists for long periods of time, for people who in any other generation would be in a position to buy their homes, who simply can't afford to do that, and who in some instances, I'm dealing with young families with their own children that are staying in their own parents' houses. None of that happened by accident. So I think the first question you need to ask anybody who is indicating that they think that this plan is going to work is whether they, in the first instance, recognise that rebuilding Ireland was an abject failure. And because if they don't do that, then I think it gives you a sense of where we're coming at with this. The headline figure in all of this is that over the lifetime of this plan, that the government now intend to build 10,000 less social houses than was originally envisaged under Rebuilding Ireland and the current projections. To talk about 2030 targets without acknowledging that there is a short and a medium term crisis that's affecting people in real terms. So unless you can say how many are going to be delivered in terms of social, affordable and other type of housing next year, the year after that, and the year after that.
You talk about a reduction in social housing, but there's a lift in affordable housing, and the overall aim is to increase supply to the point where prices are going to drop.
Well, actually, there isn't, because if you look at, for example, affordable housing, the government have indicated that they intend to move away from long-term leases, something that I think is very welcome and something I hope actually transpires to be the case. But it's not just good enough to do that unless you compensate in terms of social and affordable house building and for those 2,000 homes that were originally projected to fall under that category. None of that is in yesterday's plan. What we have is lots more rhetoric, lots more promises, but very actually little detail in terms of what this is going to mean to the people in the here and now. Because I want to know, for those families I've been describing, where are they going to be fitting in next year?
It actually is. And I've just talked there about the Land Development Agency, which is working on 600 affordable and social houses in my constituency in Shangana and Shankill. I've just talked there about taking over the planning permissions and turning those into 5,000 affordable houses. If you are so concerned about delivering housing, it is a pity that you and your party voted against the Land Development Agency, which is the single biggest intervention that we have had in any sense in housing. It is a pity that your party leader and others continue to object to 1,600 homes in North Dublin, including one bedroom homes. And the Simon community came out yesterday and said, you know what we really need actually to address long term homelessness for Housing First is one bedroom departments. We actually really need that. And she used that as a reason to object to homes of that kind. So, you know, there has to be a consistency. Do you know how many homes I've objected to, Matt? Zero. None. Because I believe that everything that contributes to try to alleviate this crisis is important and adds value. And it's so important. It's so difficult now for people who are trying to buy. You're against private home ownership. You're against your party. You're against cost rental because we're not doing it the same way. You're against anything that isn't public homes on public lands. But what about all the people who are living in private homes today, who aspire to buy a private home, who are saving up for a private home? Do they not matter to you at all?
That is a very articulate reading of the government press line. lines there, Jennifer. The reality is that all the people who are in the situation that you've described are in that position because of Fine Gael housing policy. What we need is to change that housing policy. And unfortunately, we heard over the summer that there was a battle between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in relation to this Housing for All plan. It appears categorically that Fine Gael won that because their ideology is all through this document. So when we're talking about affordable housing schemes, yes, we want to see affordable housing schemes. What's the centrepiece of the government policy? The shared equity scheme that almost everybody that has looked at this independently has said it will actually drive house prices up for the very people that you're after describing. Jennifer, you're in a constituency that the average house price is about €500,000. That doesn't happen by accident. That happens because government create the conditions within the market that actually force prices to... And to suggest that I'm against private home ownership when I'm a private home owner myself is absolute lunacy. We want to see people housed. We want to see people in the houses that they can afford. Okay. And we want to see, houses and communities that people can develop sustainable lives into the future. Nothing okay. that this government have done have created those conditions.
Okay, can we move on to reopening now? Jennifer, I'm looking at you because your life in academia is going to change quite radically now going into the new term because of the opening up and the fact that you'll have people in front of you probably Absolutely. For the first time in quite some time.
Yeah. So for an awful lot of sectors of society, arts, everything reopening, there's a lot of anxiety out there because we're, from the perspective of lecturing, we're going from completely online to completely back into the classroom. And we're delighted the students are coming back. We miss them because that's why we're lecturers. We like teaching. But we're conscious as well that a lot of our students may have an awful lot of anxiety because they may have developed, say, fears of being in groups of people. They're going to be thrown into big lecture halls, masks. And like we've seen people going in and out of supermarkets, you know, having, you know, stupid little fights about the fact they won't wear a mask. How's that going to play out when we get back in?
Mask wearing will be mandatory, will it?
Yes, unless students or staff members have medical reasons whereby they can't wear a mask.
Okay. But and you're going to be the policeman on that?
We're still waiting for final details on that and we're hitting the lecture halls next Wednesday. Mm,
that's going to be tricky.
Yeah. So, look, it's brilliant for students that they are coming back. They absolutely missed being around people in the class. And I mean, what you learn in college, 50% is the subject that you learn. The other 50% is about yourself and how you deal with other people when you're out making your own decisions for the first time in your life. The students last year never had that chance and we know that. And hopefully everything runs smoothly. We'll just all keep our fingers crossed.
Well, that's what everybody seems to be doing, Kevin, keeping the fingers crossed, because we have a very definite plan now for reopening. But when we were talking to Pascal Donoghue earlier in the week, there doesn't seem to be a plan B for winding back. But if this goes wrong, plan B will have to be arrived at pretty swiftly.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, everything is moving in one direction now. And we don't even have that same level. I think the difference this time, perhaps, if we go back to the December, November last year, like I was probably on talking to you, Claire, and when the reopening was being announced, and we all knew in the back of our minds and we all knew in our hearts that after Christmas, we were going back into lockdown. We just knew it. And I think that applied to everybody. You didn't have to be an epidemiologist to figure that one out. And it happened quicker than we perhaps thought. This time, I think people think that this is the end. And, you know, I think the hope will kill them if it's not in many ways. So I think, you know, we talked about the Catherine Zappone row and all that. And we talked about housing long term, I think, will define this government. Short term, how the next 2 months go will define an awful lot as well, because if they end up having to reverse ferret on this one, I'm not sure people will be able for it anymore.
Yeah, it's a critical time, isn't it? And we've talked a lot over the course of the week about opening, everyone going back to school and then the public transport going back to full capacity at the same time and the potential there for something to go wrong. Would it have been a better idea to separate those two things by a couple of weeks?
Look, you have to make decisions about bringing things back, and it is difficult and they are fine balances. And, you know, you're coming back a little bit now, a little bit at the end of September, a little bit at the end of October. All along, the government has having to make these choices about bringing things in together. They're not straightforward. There's no guarantee that all of this works, but the intent is there. We can see where we are with vaccinations. You talk about trust in the government. You know, the people have trusted the vaccination programme. That's why we're here. People have trusted the requests to stay home when they were made. That's why we're here. Everybody is trying to get this right. And there's no guarantee that we get to Christmas, that something doesn't happen, that there's a different variant. We just don't know. Mm-hmm. And there's no point in me trying to pretend otherwise. But based on what we know, we think we're doing well. We feel people are more comfortable. You can see it. People want to get back out. And let's hope that that's the way it continues.
Okay, Matt.
See, I think, and I agree with much of what's been said, we all want to see a situation where society reopens and that we don't ever go back to further restrictions. But I also think I always find it interesting when we're talking about public transport to someone from County Monaghan that has no literally public transport unless you plan to go to Dublin City at particular times of the day. And I think one of the big lessons we must take from this is that there are some areas of public policy that we must never return to. One of the reasons why the lockdowns were so hard in this country in comparison to others is because our health services were overstretched. The same is the case in housing and other public areas. So we need to ensure that while we're moving forward, that we never go back.
We have got to leave it there. Thank you very much, Matt Carthy, Jennifer Carol McNeil, Jennifer Kavanagh, and also Kevin Doyle. The Health Minister has just tweeted that 87.8% of people aged 16 plus in this country are fully vaccinated. Now, my next job is very important because today, at the end of this week, we're marking the end of an era on the Today Show. We have only one person to credit and to thank, and that person is Geraldine Collins, our broadcast coordinator. She is the glue that holds this show together. She has done that consistently for more years than she'd care for me to mention, so I'm not going to put a figure on it, Ger. She's done it with her trademark unflappable professionalism, legendary calm and a wicked sense of humour. And while we're all sad that Ger is saying goodbye to us today, everyone on this show and right across RT Radio 1 is so excited for you, Ger, and for what the future holds and the adventures that lie ahead. Thank you, Ger, and the very best of luck to you.